This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
French police arrest nearly 150 demonstrators in Paris for protesting police violence and a controversial security bill. The UN chief urges world leaders to declare a state of emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. And Italy becomes the European country with the highest number of coronavirus fatalities, as its total deaths now from the pandemic overtake that of the United Kingdom. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, French riot police have arrested nearly 150 demonstrators who are protesting against police violence and a controversial security bill in Paris. Hundreds of Parisians and press freedom activists took to the streets to protest against this bill. Police use water cannons to disperse protesters. The bill will increase the government's surveillance tools and restricts rights on circulating pictures of police officers in the media or online. France has been hit by a wave of street protests after the government introduced this bill in Parliament. The move is part of President Emmanuel Macron's drive to get tougher on law and order ahead of the upcoming elections in 2022. In a recent U-turn, though, Macron's ruling party said it will rewrite the article.
After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking again a popular protest. Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation.
I have the impression that Islamophobia is an important electoral trading issue. I don't think that Marine Le Pen will win the elections, but to prevent that, the actual government is playing on the ground of the far right.
A rarely seen police cordon surrounded the demonstration entirely from the beginning till the end. Every 100 meters, the police charged the demonstration and made arrests. Some were wounded. Macron had said that the presumed radical black bloc has to be destroyed. Therefore, the police had clear orders, zero tolerance. However, this time, the violence did not come from the demonstrators. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims.
There's so much ambiguity in the formulation of the bill that anyone can be accused of anything anytime. The head of police can dissolve any association on any grounds. With this law, justice does not exist anymore. The democratic state does not exist anymore. Anyone who is a bit annoyed by Muslims can use this law in an arbitrary way. It has to be abolished, same as the law on global security.
The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money.
The new bill will be discussed in the French Parliament. Members of the majority party already declared that they want to modify the text. Some want to soften it, others want to make it even more restrictive. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres has called on world leaders to declare states of climate emergency in their countries.
If we don't change course, we may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of more than 3 degrees this century. Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency?
Guterres said if the world fails to change course, then it may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of over 3 Celsius degrees the century. He was speaking at a summit on the fifth anniversary of the Paris Climate Accord, which aims to tackle global warming. The U.S. President-elect Joe Biden sent a written statement to the virtual summit, pledging to rejoin the Paris Act on the first day of his presidency. The U.S. withdrew from the International Accord back in 2017 under President Donald Trump. Country is the world's second largest polluter after China. A UK government source reiterates the U.S. or European Union's current offer on a post-Brexit trade deal remains unacceptable to Britain. Source said the British Premier will leave no stone unturned during the process. He said Boris Johnson, however, is clear that any agreement must be fair and respect the position that the UK will be a sovereign nation in 3 weeks' time. Talks between Britain and the European Union on a post-Brexit deal continued overnight. Main sources of contention between the two remain fishing rights, economic fair play, and dispute settlement. Two sides have set a deadline of Sunday to find an agreement and prevent a chaotic break. Austria's Constitutional Court has overturned a ban against headscarves in elementary schools. Court said the ban, which was approved by Parliament last year, violates the principle of equality and runs the risk of marginalizing Muslim girls. Ruling is seen as a victory for Austria's Muslims. Homolezgi reports.
In a move lauded by Austria's Muslim community, the National Constitutional Court has officially lifted the ban on headscarves at elementary schools. The controversial ban, approved last year by the previous conservative right-wing coalition government, has now been ruled unconstitutional. The court's president says it singles out the religion of Islam unjustifiably, goes against the religious and ideological neutrality of the state, and violates the principle of equality.
The selective ban could have an adverse effect on the inclusion of students and lead to discrimination. It excludes Islamic origin and tradition and carries the risk of making it difficult for Muslim girls to access education and could marginalize them from society.
Austria's Islamic faith community, which had filed a complaint about the ban in January, welcomed the ruling, saying it would end a populist prohibition policy.
We are against constraints and prohibitions because, as it is said in the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the matter of faith. Our trust in the rule of law and our patience have paid off.
The ban prevented girls up to the age of 10 from wearing headscarves in school.
I think this is a big step forward because schoolgirls are often discriminated because of their hijab, and with this new rule they should be able to live it out freely and without any discrimination, even if it's by other school students or teachers. So I think it's kind of a part of a revolution.
While the opposition Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Greens all welcomed the decision, members of the Conservative ruling party called it regrettable, and the right-wing Freedom Party even suggested attempts to reinstate it. The ban's proponents argued they were protecting young girls from being pressured into observing the hijab.
But Muslim families deny this allegation, saying using force against girls who choose to wear the headscarf undermines efforts to give them equal opportunities and self-determination. And this time, they've won the argument. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Number of coronavirus infections in the Netherlands has seen its biggest daily increase since October. According to official data, COVID cases in the country jumped by more than 9,000 over the past 24 hours. And this raises the country's total infections to over 600,000. Disease has so far claimed over 10,000 lives in the Netherlands. Also on Saturday, Italy's virus deaths jumped by nearly 650 to over 64,000. The country has now reclaimed the record from the UK for highest number of coronavirus deaths in Europe. The continent has been struggling with a second wave of outbreak for several weeks now. And earlier, Max Jabili joined us with the latest on the coronavirus situation in Italy.
Contagion rate has slowed, and also the number of new hospital admissions has been going down in recent weeks. But, as you said before, Italy is still reporting more daily COVID-19 fatalities than any other European nation. The obvious questions for many Italians are, has the country's healthcare system failed to protect the elderly? Has the government done all it was necessary to tackle the pandemic as it delayed new imposing new restrictions? Bear in mind that the average age of Italian victims stands at around 80, and 6 out of 10 COVID-19 dead had 3 or more other health problems before they tested positive, hypertension, diabetes, lung issues. Germany, it has a similarly old demographic, and yet its death toll is one-third of Italy's, despite its larger population of 83 million. It has 21,000 dead overall. So basically, Italy has to ask itself why Germany is doing much better.
U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Panel has recommended the COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer and BioNTech is appropriate now for Americans over the age of 16. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices voted now for the vaccine 11-0 with 3 abstentions. The recommendation comes after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued an emergency authorization for the vaccine, clearing it now for public use. Hospitals in the country are expected to start rolling out vaccination plans on their employees as early as Monday. Confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. have surpassed 16 million, and the virus has so far claimed nearly 300,000 American lives. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has paid a visit to neighboring Afghanistan for talks on mutual issues. During his visit, he once again declared Tehran's readiness to offer further support to Afghanistan in various sectors. Amin Alemi reports.
Meeting top Afghan officials to finalize the joint comprehensive strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan was the major reason behind the visit of Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Sayed Abbas Araghchi to the Afghan capital, Kabul. Analysts say the move will further boost the ties between Iran and Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul was fruitful for both sides. Both sides have agreed to finalize the joint comprehensive and strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan. This is a win-win deal, helping Kabul and Tehran boost their ties.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Iranian official stressed the importance of expansion of ties between Kabul and Tehran through numerous ways, including increase of strategic partnership in different fields. He also stressed that bringing peace and political stability to Afghanistan under an Afghan-owned process is one of priorities of Tehran's regional policy.
We would remain backing Iraqi Afghan government and people in their fight for their for peace and stability and prosperity. We do consider peace and security in Afghanistan as our own peace and security, and we do consider the prosperity of Afghan people as the prosperity of Iranians. So we are certainly after a good, constructive, mutually beneficial relations with Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul comes as both countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have recently inaugurated the first joint railway project connecting western Afghanistan to eastern Iran as a proof of growing cooperation between both countries. Mutual ties between Kabul and Tehran are expanding as both sides are fighting U.S.-sponsored terrorism and sanctions. But the two countries, observers say, have proved that they will never set back against enemies. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Morocco's main Islamic groups have rejected Rabat's plan to normalize ties with Israel following a deal brokered by the U.S. religious branch of co-ruling party, the PJD, in a statement called the move deplorable. Unity and Reform Movement also denounced all attempts at normalization, what it called Zionist infiltration. Unlike its government's coalition partners who backed the deal, took the PJD 2 days to react amid divisions among the party's senior leadership. On Friday, Morocco's major opposition party, the Adawal Isaini, condemned normalization deals with Israel as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. And the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has raised the alarm about a hike in Israel's demolitions of Palestinian homes. Hamas says the demolitions amount to an all-out war on Palestinians. Earlier in our news review program, who discussed this issue in detail. Let's have a listen. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called for the formation of a unified front to counter Israel's demolition of homes in the occupied West Bank. Now, a Hamas spokesperson said regime's demolition drives represent an all-out war on Palestinians, which needs to be countered by adopting a joint strategy. Hazem Qassem said a hike in razing Palestinian homes shows regime is gradually implementing its plans of annexation. He noted rise comes on the heels of U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and a number of Arab states. According to the UN, over 50 buildings have been razed by Israeli forces over the past 2 weeks in the occupied West Bank. And now joining us for this news review is Zafar Bangesh, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us from Toronto, Canada, and Kay Pritzker, journalist at Breakthrough News, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast. We'll start there in Canada and head down south. We'll start with you, Mr. Zafar Bangesh. Your initial thoughts on this, Zafar, and why do you think, I mean, the demolition drives have been blasted by the UN, by the Europeans. We don't hear anything in terms of sanctions or anything with any teeth to get the Israelis to stop what they're doing. Why?
Well, basically, because the Zionist state of Israel is the illegitimate child of the Western world. It's in fact a Western beachhead right in the heartland of Islam, and in particular in the Holy Land. And what we witness is the home demolitions that are going on in the West Bank, as well as in Jerusalem, incidentally. There are at least 700 Palestinians in East Jerusalem that are under threat of eviction. And there is a particularly virulent group of Zionist settlers by the name of Atarat Kohanim that has been at the forefront of pushing the Palestinians out of their homes and taking them over forcibly. And if the Palestinians don't leave, then they even actually, unfortunately, the courts in Israel are all on the sides of the Israeli settlers. And so they even fine the Palestinian homeowners and demand of them that they should even pay rent. So to answer your question directly as to why there is no protest or no voices being raised against home demolitions, it is because the Western world, the governments in the Western world, are all in league with the Zionist state of Israel.
Thank you, Zafar. And Kipretzer, okay, I want you, if you could, get into this dimension of it. Tell us how these recent normalization deals with certain Arab countries have impacted what we're seeing taking place. We've always seen the mistreatment of Palestinians, but to have them on a daily basis having their homes razed and becoming homeless in the cold right now and this pandemic, tell us how that all ties together.
Yeah, the normalization is incredibly dangerous, and it just shows how far a lot of these Arab states have retreated. And, you know, I would add, I don't think a lot of the people in countries like the UAE or in Saudi Arabia support the actions of their governments trying to normalize relations with Israel. But, you know, these governments do it largely because of money and because of trade and finance. You know, they're willing to sell out their Arab sisters and brothers. They're willing to sell out the Palestinian cause. And, you know, it's the colonization, it's the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that has caused such a humanitarian crisis in Palestine, and has deprived so many people of jobs and of a way to make a living. And Israel, which has profited through that colonization, Israel, which has, you know, built all these advanced industries on top of that stolen land, is now leveraging that technology, leveraging that wealth to strike these trade deals with, you know, these countries. So, you know, I don't think we can rely on the leadership of these countries to fight for the Palestinians. It has to be people.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. So Zafar Bangesh, they're joining us from Toronto, Canada, and Keith Pritzker, that is, joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for this segment of your news review. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jail journalist's human rights. The WikiLeaks founder's prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate, said United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture Niels Melzer. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Not a Criminal. Top UN anti-torture official urges Julian Assange release. Here's the details. The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jailed journalist's human rights. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture Niels Melzer's comments came in a statement noting reports that some 65 of the 165 inmates at Belmarsh, including numerous prisoners in the wing where Assange is jailed, have tested positive for coronavirus. Assange's legal team has repeatedly called for his release, citing pre-existing health conditions, including heart problems and respiratory infections that place the 49-year-old journalist and publisher at elevated risk for potentially deadly COVID-19 complications. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention previously found that Assange had been arbitrarily deprived of his freedom since his arrest on December 7, 2010, including house arrest, imprisonment in London, and 7 years spent receiving political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in the British capital. Assange has been imprisoned in Belmarsh in conditions described by Melzer as near total isolation since April 2019, as he awaits a UK court's decision on whether he will be extradited to the United States to face charges of violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified US military documents and files on WikiLeaks a decade ago. Among the materials published by WikiLeaks are the Afghanistan and Iraq war logs, which revealed U.S. and coalition war crimes, many of them leaked by Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Perhaps the most infamous of the leaks is the so-called collateral murder video, which shows U.S. Army attack helicopter crews laughing as they gunned down a group of Iraqi civilians that included journalists and children. While the soldiers and commanders implicated in the materials published by the WikiLeaks have largely enjoyed impunity, Manning served 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by outgoing President Barack Obama in 2017. Meanwhile, Assange faces up to 175 years behind bars if found guilty of all charges against him. The British authorities initially detained Ms. Assange on the basis of an arrest warrant issued by Sweden in connection with allegations of sexual misconduct that have since been formally dropped due to lack of evidence, Melzer said in a statement. Today, he is detained for exclusively preventative purposes to ensure his presence during the ongoing U.S. extradition trial, a proceeding which may well last several years. Mr. Assange is not a criminal convict and poses no threat to anyone, so his prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate and clearly lacks any legal basis, Melzer continued. There have been growing calls for President Donald Trump to pardon Assange during his last week in office, including by exiled former National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden, filmmaker Oliver Stone, and musician Roger Waters. Melzer, who has repeatedly called Assange's treatment torture, added that the whistleblower's rights have been severely violated for more than a decade. Additionally, Melzer advised British authorities to decline the U.S. extradition request, citing serious human rights concerns in a nation whose prisons are rife with torture, rape, and other abuses. He must now be allowed to live in a normal way, normal family, social, and professional life, to recover his health and to adequately prepare his defense against the U.S. extradition request pending against him, he said.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyyi al-Azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-Tayyibin al-Tahirin la siyama baqiyatillah fil arabin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarih. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammare, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and Mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلَنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنزَلْنَا مَعَهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانِ لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ.
One of the beautiful verses of the Quran about this ummah which is going to be established, this community which is going to be established, is this ayah, Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس. We have designed Islam in the way that you can be a balanced nation so that you would be witnesses for other nations. If Prophet is your leader, he is a witness for you, you are also to be leader and witness for other people. لَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. Rasulullah is your leader, and you have to follow him and become leader for other nations. Not by force, not by sword. There is no matter of sword. Was Rasulullah leader of Muslims by sword? No, they loved him. They followed him because they loved him. If you are balanced, people follow you because they love you. If people see that our community, and we don't need to wait, you know, for the whole ummah to wake up. We can start from our own local community. We can start from London. We can start from even northwest London or any part of, you know, any town. This can start with few people. Most of the prophets started with few people. Yes, some of the prophets inherited already an ummah, a community. But many people started with just few people. We can start it from here. If we achieve this balance, and this has many, many dimensions, balance between secular education and religious education. This needs by itself, you know, one Muharram to talk. How we sometimes lose this balance. Everything goes for secular education. Or, in rare cases, everything goes for religious education. Both are wrong. Of course, the first is more common, but maybe the second is also happening. We need both. We don't need to sacrifice one for the sake of other. Why we cannot be very advanced in secular education, but at the same time be very advanced in religious education? Why we cannot spend money, energy, attention to the religious education of our children as we do for our secular education?
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all opened our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all opened our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
I know that there are people who even have financial problems, but still they are ready, and I don't, you know, have any problem, I appreciate, to borrow money to send their children to private schools or grammar schools. They have really shortage of money, but still they're happy to do this. This is good. I'm not saying they should stop or they should do. I'm saying I don't have any problem. But how many people are ready to borrow money to provide their children with religious education? When it comes to religious education, we do tawakkul. Inshallah, it will be all right. When it comes to secular education, there is no tawakkul. Even when sometimes, you know, we say, people, you know, please let us have our own Islamic schools. And if we work as a community, for sure, even in secular, you know, records, we can be very successful. But they say, no, we cannot take risk. We can send our children, you know, to schools which are already established. They don't do any tawakkul. They don't do any sacrifice. They are not ready to take any risk. Although this is not a risk which is not realistic. If we really work together as a community, we can have best secular education in our Islamic schools. But there is no sign of tawakkul here. But when it comes to religious education, just attending mosque, we think it's enough, if we attend. Just sending to madrasa for a few hours, we think it's enough. So this is not going to work. We need to have balance.
I'm looking back throughout the years. To breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif.
Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillah rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Mark Garnett, a politics professor at Lancaster University, suggested the United Kingdom will be worse off under any post-Brexit economic arrangement with the European Union. He does not believe the leavers who claim Britain will quickly recover and end up being stronger economically. Professor Mark Garnett warned, in their eyes, no deal might actually be better for the UK because it will supposedly maximise the country's ability to make its own economic decisions. This argument has little support among economists or the business community and seems even less convincing since the economy has suffered the additional shock of the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by Ekaterina Blinova, a freelance journalist who has been a Sputnik contributor since 2014. The piece is titled, No Deal Brexit, Why UK Claims It Is Not Scared by Worst Case Scenario. Please stay with us to hear more of Ekaterina Blinova's article. While the United Kingdom and the European Union have yet to reach an agreement, one might ask who is set to lose the most from the looming no-deal Brexit. Although some economic specialists expect dramatic disruptions for the British economy, others claim that the United Kingdom will reap some purported benefits from a no-deal outcome. Although on 7th of December, EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, told the European Parliament that 9th of December was a deadline to strike a deal with Britain. An EU-UK compromise is nowhere near. Following the Wednesday, 9th of December, crunch talks between European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the two set a new deadline, stressing that either a Brexit deal will be sealed by 13th of December or there will be no deal at all. Meanwhile, citing the negotiators, The Guardian reported very large gaps remain between the United Kingdom and the European Union despite 9 months of bumpy talks. The sides have yet to find common ground with regards to three pressing issues: the level playing field, fish, and governance. A no-deal Brexit is looming as time is running out for the participants of the talks. Theophanis Exodactilos, a senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey, argues, It is extremely crucial for the United Kingdom to reach a deal with the European Union in order to be able to have a smooth transition into the new relationship between the UK and the European Union. Exodactilos added, An agreement guarantees the continuation of the flow of goods in and out of the UK. It ensures the non-disruption of the flow of people and makes travelling easier. The senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey noted the possibility of the worst-case scenario has already prompted a transfer of jobs across the English Channel to France, to Germany, and to Netherlands, and many companies have moved operations to European centres rather than within the United Kingdom. He expected that a no-deal exit could hit British farmers, who would no longer receive subsidies from the European Union budget, as well as the fisheries and tourism industries, logistic chains, manufacturing, and business exchanges. He said, non-agreement will definitely affect those companies with extra import duties, taxes, and delays at the borders. The senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey, Theophanis Exodactilos, added, I'm not sure that any sector will gain substantially. Overall, no deal is no better than some deal with the EU. Britain, at the end of the day, will have a relationship with the European Union by default, so it's best to have it on some terms, rather than World Trade Organization terms, which would exclude it widely from trading and engaging the European Union as a bloc. Mark Garnett, a politics professor at Lancaster University, suggested the United Kingdom will be worse off under any post-Brexit economic arrangement with the European Union. He does not believe the leavers who claim Britain will quickly recover and end up being stronger economically. Professor Mark Garnett warned, in their eyes, no deal might actually be better for the UK, because it will supposedly maximise the country's ability to make its own economic decisions. This argument has little support among economists or the business community, and seems even less convincing since the economy has suffered the additional shock of the coronavirus pandemic. Still, it does not appear that the British government is scared by the no-deal scenario, despite the grim prognosis. In October, Prime Minister Boris Johnson made it clear that he preferred no deal to a bad deal, claiming on the Andrew Marr show that the United Kingdom could prosper mightily under those circumstances. Addressing his party fellows a year ago, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson noted that he wishes to avoid, but is prepared for, a no-deal withdrawal. Richard Wellings, acting research director at the British think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs, argues, While a no-deal Brexit would cause short-term disruption, particularly for manufacturers with complex supply chains, it could bring benefits in the long term. Richard Wellings claimed it would give the United Kingdom the opportunity to free itself from the huge burden of the EU regulations, reducing costs for businesses and consumers. Freer trade with the rest of the world would mean lower prices for consumers, who would no longer be forced to buy goods from overpriced European Union producers. UK manufacturers would also be freer to source their components from cheaper sources outside of the European Union. Richard Wellings, acting research director at the British think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs, added, "When it comes to the EU's agricultural and food processing sectors, they're likely to be hit hard too, as UK consumers will shift to lower cost supplies in the rest of the world." The think tank director noted, "The bloc's car industry may also suffer as Britons will acquire better value products from emerging economies," claiming that given all of the above, the main losers from a no-deal divorce are likely to be EU producers that are currently shielded from global competition by protectionist tariffs, by quotas and by regulation. However, Richard Wellings said, to capitalize on all these purported benefits, the British government must adopt policies of deregulation and trade liberalization. Meanwhile, negotiators of the European Union and the United Kingdom are continuing to chew over the provisions of a potential post-Brexit trade deal, as neither of the parties involved seems willing to quit the talks first. The Spectator's James Forsyth maintained neither Boris Johnson nor his European counterparts wants to become a target of the blame game, which will inevitably start if the negotiations collapse. At the same time, while the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, would still prefer to have a deal, he no longer needs one, unlike in October of 2019, when he led a minority government. James Forsyth wrote, "In parliamentary terms, he does not need a deal the way he did last year." Johnson, on Thursday, 10th of December, vowed to go the extra mile for a Brexit trade deal, but instructed his government to prepare for Britain to crash out of the European Union's single market at the end of this year. The gloom deepened over the drawn-out Brexit saga after Boris Johnson and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, over a combative dinner in Brussels, declared on Sunday, 13th of December, a deadline to decide whether to keep talking or to give up. Boris Johnson stressed he wanted his negotiators to keep going and will go the extra mile for a last gasp deal, and said he was ready to travel again to Brussels as well as to Paris or Berlin to get one over the line. But speaking after a rare evening meeting of the cabinet, the Conservative leader claimed his ministers agreed very strongly with me that the deal on the table is really not at the moment right for the United Kingdom. The pound, meanwhile, has slumped on currency markets as traders adjust to the looming possibility that after 5 decades of integration between Britain and mainland Europe, cross-channel trade will be subject anew to tariffs and quotas in the new year. Britain left the European Union on 31st of January, but a standstill transition period under which it remains bound by the bloc's rules pending any new deal ends on the night of 31st of December. Without a post-Brexit deal, Britain's trade with its biggest market will in future operate on pared-down World Trade Organization WTO rules, or Australian terms, as Boris Johnson prefers to call them, for public consumption. Johnson said, "We've not stopped talking, we'll continue to negotiate, but looking at where we are, I do think it's vital that everyone now gets ready for that Australian option." He accused the European Union of shifting the goalposts in the past fortnight by reviving demands for equivalence, meaning Britain will be bound to follow future regulatory standards laid down by Brussels to prevent either side gaining a competitive edge. He said refusal would mean Britain facing punishment, sanctions, tariffs, or whatever, adding, "The other big sticking point remained EU members' future access to Britain's rich fishing waters." He said, "After many years now of voting to leave the European Union, we wouldn't still have control of our waters, and that's no good." And so the cabinet agreed very strongly with it that we're really not there yet at all. Britain's chief negotiator David Frost and his European Union counterpart Michel Barnier resumed talks in Brussels on Thursday, 10th of December, despite the mounting pessimism. With nerves frayed on both sides of the channel, Ursula von der Leyen's outline of a backup plan to protect road, air travel and fishing rights was seen as a no-deal warning shot. Even though talks were still taking place, he said there was no guarantee any agreement could be in place by January the 1st, given the tight time frame. Several EU member states, notably France, have pushed the European Commission and Michel Barnier to take a tougher line and publish the contingency plan to show Britain they're ready for a no deal. The European Commission, the bloc's executive, called the plan a set of targeted contingency measures, which would come to an end if a deal is found or after a fixed period. Basic air transport will continue for 6 months provided Britain agrees to reciprocate, as will access for road haulage. The interim fisheries regulation would continue until the end of 2021, but it provides for continued reciprocal access by European Union and United Kingdom vessels to each other's waters. Boris Johnson's government, which raised hopes of a breakthrough earlier this week with a separate agreement governing trade in Northern Ireland, promised only to study the proposals whilst restating its demands for Brussels to respect UK sovereignty. Many businesses are aghast at still being forced to wait to learn what rules will operate in 3 weeks' time, and accuse the government of failing to plan properly. Congestion building at key seaports is being seen as a sign of things to come. On Wednesday, 9th of December, Japanese carmaker Honda suspended production at its Swindon plant, west of London, because of a shortage of components. James Sibley, head of international affairs at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, "I think there's going to be terrible disruption in January," he added. "That will continue to be the case after a transition period ends, whether that's with a free trade agreement or otherwise."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.